Hi-ho, silver away! In honor of John Wick Chapter 3, what's your favorite horse-based action sequence?
I'm Katie Rich, and there is a scene in the movie Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter in which a vampire uses a horse as a weapon. That movie is absurd. It kind of makes me proud to be an American.
To that horse scene, I say nay. I am Matt Patches, and I'm going to go with True Lies, because Arnold Schwarzenegger rides a horse through a mall. Suck it, John Wick.
And I'm David the Seven, and I'm going with Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade when the horse gets Indy to the tank. Practical horse. Well, I guess Patches is also a practical horse. I hope
Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter, horse. Nothing. No, the actors aren't even practical.
No, the horse in True Lies was motion captured by Sam Worthington.
A teenage Sam Worthington.
Yes.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good. Then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine then, and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's awesome. Hello and welcome to Fighting in the War Room. It's episode 257, and it's the week of Wednesday, May 15th. On that day in 2002, I was very close to being graduated from high school, and it's the day that Bowling for Columbine premiered at the Cannes Film Festival. Fun facts for everybody.
We should have kept it. Katie Rich is very close to graduating.
Yeah, like 2 weeks away from high school graduation. Don't we all remember it that way?
And you couldn't attend your graduation because you were at Cannes attending your Bowling for Columbine.
Obviously. There was a girl in my high school who went to Sundance like 1 year with her dad, and it blew my mind. Like, I thought it was the coolest thing that a person could do. Like, I didn't realize.
And now you know it was.
Well, I didn't realize that you could just like go to a film festival as a person. Like, I learned later. Anyway, speaking of film festivals, David is at Cannes, hopefully eating some bread and sleeping a little bit.
Eating bread.
Yeah.
Only bread. Just
eating bread.
That's what I would do at Cannes.
Rolls.
You send me to Cannes, I will eat some French bread.
Pan.
We are hoping to get a dispatch from him next week, but there are no guarantees. He's in France. You never know what might happen. But anyway, we're going to forge on without him. So Patches, do we have reviews?
We do. We have four short, sweet reviews. Let's fly through them all because we love reviews and we'll read whatever you send us. So from Wonderbow, they write 5 stars. Are we living American gods? ?
Oh boy.
A++++++. The Disney monolith rant in the Endgame episode. American gods is real. Here for the solid morale, political compass, and the great insight and lively discourse. Keep up the excellence. More Dave.
Should I be watching American Gods?
I think all you need to know there is that they live in fear of the media god.
Oh.
Is that right, Dave? But
sure. I mean, I haven't watched this television show, but that seems accurate to the book, which I didn't like. But Joanna Robinson, big fan of American Gods, also didn't watch the new season, so I feel vindicated.
Hearsay. Well, that's the beauty of Fighting the War Room. You get the real talk about Disney. The monolith of culture. Who else is going there? Who? Anyway.
Who else left us a review?
5 stars from EJM122191, who has a name from the future, who says, fun and insightful. Here's a 5-star rating because the David impressions at the start of episode 255 gave me more laughs than anything this year. I don't remember this happening. People keep tweeting about it, so I guess it did. And if it brings you joy, then fine. That was another David impression. Another 5-star review from Strangelove87, who says, love it. Been listening since the Op Kino days. Had to finally leave a review. Wow. Because it was great to hear you all rip Infinity War a new one while praising Endgame. Needed some of that sanity. And I also need to thank Matt Patches for his segment on I Think You Should Leave. What a fantastic show. Feel free to cut this last part out, but the Crystal Skull episode of Blank Check featuring David Ehrlich is hilarious. Well, we don't cut out a single line of your reviews, but we do shame you.
Please don't mention Blank
broadcast.
Check in our reviews.
Yeah, what the fuck?
Go ahead and mention us in your reviews of Blank Check, though, just to even it out.
Exactly.
That'll show them.
And to end on a sour note, 3 stars. less David, please, still, from Sweet Jane 13.
That's the whole thing?
No. That's the subject. The review goes as such. I don't know why you all let David talk so much. He dominates the conversation. I suspect because he loves the sound of his own voice. Don't we all? I would not ever listen to him alone, but Katie, Dave, and Patches make the podcast enjoyable. Please, less David and more of everyone else. And bring back Joanna Robinson once in a while. Well,
that's
good news.
That's an indisputable fact.
David is not here, but we love David and we want to hear David's voice.
I will be guesting on a future episode of a podcast called Talk Nerdy to Me. It's my third time on there, and I was talking to Riley, the host, and he's like, I will get David Ehrlich and I'll let him talk about whatever he wants. And I'm like, go to David Ehrlich and just talk to him about like video games, because I have questions. Like he plays like, he wants to talk about these video games that he's playing. They're video games that are like super narratively dense and in some case like very difficult. Like, is David good at video games? Like, he's secretly good at poker?
I would love for us, next time we're all in one place, to play a video game together. Should we do that?
What game would we multiplayer?
I mean,
Mario Party.
We should start a Twitch stream where the four of us play video games.
Would we all communally have to live in a house with all of our families supported by the income of this Twitch stream?
I mean, if we're all living in a house supported by our families, we're getting a sponsor. Like, that's a show.
The house is sponsored. It's like Big Brother.
Yeah.
When we're not doing the show, some of us are doing the Twitch stream. It's really just the house is... There are certain rooms that are just broadcasting.
Do we do it when the children are old enough to play video games or not?
Well, see, I do think you guys need to start thinking about when you're going to monetize your children. Oh, Maybe that should be a segment on the podcast coming up.
Yeah, we'll get there. When David's back, we'll figure out a strategy for the future.
Yeah, right when they get to the, we'll say anything that you say back to you, but don't know what it means, you're already too late in monetizing your children. Like, you should be rolling in dough by that point. This is an interesting podcast. Let's start the podcast. Thanks for leaving us reviews. We read them here usually.
Keep doing it. This weekend brought the Netflix release of the movie Wine Country, which is the directorial debut of Amy Poehler. It stars Amy Poehler along with a group of women who are, in fact, her real-life friends, most of whom are famous for having been on SNL, like Maya Rudolph and Anna Gasteyer and Rachel Dratch and Tina Fey. Paula Pell and Emily Spivey are in it. They were writers for SNL, less known for acting. Apparently, it's based on a trip they all took to Wine Country for Rachel Dratch's 50th birthday, and it's one of those movies with a bunch of famous comedians that obviously feels very autobiographical and possibly like they filmed their vacation.
It's based on a previous trip they took, because I assume that this trip is the one that they took.
Well, no, Rachel Dratch is now 53, so, you know.
I see. So they just went for round two by...
Yeah, like the best vacation you ever took, you get to go like do it again and film a movie about it.
We should do that. Scrap the house playing video games together. Let's go on a trip and Kickstarter the Fighting in the War Room movie where we go on vacation.
The terrible truth about Wine Country is that it's bad. It's a bad movie. It is like very sporadically funny. It's got people acting funny, and that if you were in the room with them, you would be laughing. But it's not good. The script is really basic. Amy Poehler's direction is not doing a lot for it. I like everything about the concept and the people who are in it, and it feels bad to be mean about it. But it's not good, and it bummed me out.
It's not being mean about it. I think did we have high expectations for this movie? Because you watched this movie independently of us ever talking about it. I mean, it came out of nowhere. There wasn't a lot of hype, or people weren't on a press tour for Wine Country.
No, but they
another
like
Netflix movie.
They like promoted, like when they announced they were filming it last summer, there was excitement about it. Amy Poehler, Maya Rudolph were in a Vanity Fair feature a couple months ago. I mean, there was some.
Well, there you go.
Energy there.
Oh, right. Because Amy Poehler actually wore a wonderful like suit or something. Someone wore a suit in Vanity Fair.
I believe Amy Poehler wore a suit.
It was a very good suit. It was a lot more interesting than Wine Country. But what I'm getting at here is that we like all independently watched this movie. I guess we're of the age. We're parents who watched Parks and Rec is our demographic that Wine Country appealed to. And for some, we were all home on Friday because our kids need to go to bed. So we watched Wine Country. hoping, I guess, that it was going to be... I mean, what was the best case scenario for Wine Country? What did we think this was going to be? Bridesmaids? Kind of low budge?
Bridesmaids is the comparison, I think. Like, I thought about, you know, as I was watching this and kind of, like, bummed that none of the characters existed, I was like, God, Bridesmaids is, like... Bridesmaids is a rambly movie, but it is, like, ruthlessly efficient compared to Wine Country, in which you, like... It, like, sets up, like, very basic character struggles for all of the characters and kind of threads them throughout with, like, as, like, the hint of a plot, but none of it really is part of the story, and there's no character development whatsoever that actually happens by the end.
But that's the funny part, because I think what derails this movie, and I mean, I would still, I guess, recommend, like, if you're looking for something, if you want to stop searching and scrolling through Netflix on a Friday night, you could do worse than Wine Country.
Totally.
Because Rachel Dratch and Amy Poehler and Anna Gasteyer, Maya Rudolph, Paula Pell, and all the rest of these people are naturally funny and enjoyable. But I want to get to the bottom of why this movie, what does Bridesmaids do that's so good, and why the comedy is so functional and fun that Wine Country stumbles so hard? Is it because it really, I mean, for me, I guess there's no script. Like, nothing in this movie happens, and it gets really serious. Maya Rudolph's character thinks she might have breast cancer, and Rachel Dratch is in a horrible marriage, and Anna Gasteyer doesn't have time for her friends anymore because she's too busy, and Amy Poehler's character just lost her job, and she's getting old, and everyone has horrible problems, and they don't get resolved in fun ways. It's not funny. There are not jokes in this movie. It's actually more like Sideways if you got all these women into that vehicle, minus the harsh cynicism that would make that movie.
Well, and it's like, it's like bits. It's watching, like, you know, the scene where Paula Pell's character, like, gives them all out vibrators as gifts, and, like, it's funny that she's doing it, and, like, she makes jokes about it, but it's like, it's the kind of thing where if you were in the room with it, it would be great, and watching it happen isn't that satisfying, because there's not characters around it. It's not set up. Like, it's not presented in any of the way that makes jokes funny.
I'm laughing just thinking about Wine Country, because it's like the opposite of improvisational logic. Like, the number one rule of improv is yes and. Just keep going with the bit or keep exaggerating. And Wine Country is like the movie where everyone goes into a scene and says no. And there's this scene where they all get together. It's like the first night of their big wine trip. And Anna Gasteyer's character brings Molly. And she's like, what if we all did Molly? I've been reading about microdosing. And it's like a 5-minute scene where they're all like, no, let's not do that.
But it is funny when they're all like, there's a podcast. And I'm like, oh yeah, I'd listen to the podcast. Like, there are jokes in there. Like, there are moments of this, like Tina Fey's doing this really weird character as, like, the owner of the house that they're all vacationing in. Like, that was funny. Like, there's individual,
is it funny?
The way that Maya Rudolph dances is funny, but it's all bits. It's like stuff that you can imagine them doing in the SNL writer's room to make each other laugh, that they're like, oh yeah, we're putting this in a movie. And there was just no one to say, this doesn't work.
I mean, even my parents saw this movie. I saw them on Mother's Day. They're doing well. Thanks for asking. They also independently watch Wine Country. That was a rude awakening for me.
Well, your dad's a wine expert.
That's true. He's very into wine, but I still, like, when my parents and I are both flocking to see the same movie on Netflix on a Friday night, that's an awakening. I have to come to terms with that. The point is, they were like, there were no jokes. This is not a funny movie. It's so dysfunctional. And I think we should talk about Amy Poehler as her directorial debut. Like, I just thought this would be, she's an amazing producer. I think we need to recognize what Amy Poehler has done the past 10 years, which is have her family go through a horrible divorce, it should be noted, from Will Arnett.
And, like, I mean, it was, totally, do we know that it was horrible? It's, I don't know. Do you know things
I mean,
I know?
It just, from all accounts, it just seems like it didn't go well. And I don't know. She's done a lot of comedy that has riffed on that, I feel like. But,
sure. She wrote a memoir.
And she's done a lot of, like, I'm an independent woman. I'm, like, breaking free of this. She started, what was the website that she started?
Smart Girls.
So yeah, Smart Girls, and she did this craft show that I think we talked about on the podcast over the summer. I hope that comes back. That kind of, like,
oh, her show with Nick Offerman.
Crafts, yes, that is a joy. She's just, like, 100% full of joy. She produced Broad City. She's been producing a lot of TV
and
shows.
Difficult and People, Russian people. Doll.
Yeah, she's on fire. She's doing so many good things. So it was like really exciting for her to step up and direct this movie. And it's really just a couple's retreat, or, you know, that the notorious movie of, yeah, a true Adam Sandler joint. That's exactly what this is. And my mom made the best point, I got to say, which is, I was like, this movie sucks and I'm really disappointed. And she's like, well, it does, but I'm really glad they got to make it. Like, Amy Poehler and her friend should be able to make bad movies where they go on vacation together. And I'm like, yeah, I guess they should. Like, this is what everyone getting the same opportunities is all about, making bad movies with your friends.
Is
because
it?
You're all famous enough to do it.
Sure.
Well, I guess that's a question. Is it? You tell me.
I mean, like, I agree with your mom that Amy Poehler and her very funny friend should be able to do whatever they want. I don't know that I should need to watch it. And I wanted to believe that they were smarter than Adam Sandler and wouldn't make a bad movie about them all going on vacation. Like, to know that it is not enough to actually make a movie out of it. It doesn't make me think that Amy Poehler's not smart, because obviously she's smart, but like, whatever decision making went into this, like, someone was not looking past, like, oh, this guy's hilarious. Like, you should be a comedian. Like, it's so something that's funny in person and is not funny on film.
Yeah, I think there's a point and shoot aspect to this movie that you think it should work if everyone can improv their way in and out of scenes and take weird situational comedy and make it work. But the scenes drag on forever. There's a bit where they're like all individually rolling down a hill one by one. I feel like that's 8 years. And yet the scenes where Amy Poehler is not in the movie, which I feel like is a signal, are some of the best, or at least where she is maybe kind of like doing a two-hander as opposed to juggling all these women.
She and Jason Schwartzman are funny.
Yes, yes. So this is the scene I want to bring up. That Jason Schwartzman is the movie. I don't know if this is something that really happens in Sonoma County or whatever, but like, they rent this Airbnb and Jason Schwartzman is the personal chef who just comes with the Airbnb. Sure, great. He spends most of the movie preparing
paella.
And then the scene where you finally see him, he's finally making the paella. It's a gigantic, it's enormous. It's oversized.
It's like a trash can lid. No bigger than that.
No, it's huge. It's a giant fire pit size, cast iron skillet making paella in this movie that is mostly realistic. And then Amy Poehler is trying to have a conversation with him while making paella. And that is hysterical. And then there's another bit. It's all the side players who are really good. Maya Erskine from Pen 15 is in this movie. Playing what I thought was a throwaway role as like waitress, and then she turns out to be an artist.
Oh, Paula Pell's
grand dresser.
Yeah,
like what? So weird, but she's really funny too. So I mean, I
She's really funny. But that whole Fran Drescher art show scene is like them dunking on millennials in this way that's like probably very satisfying if you're in your late 40s and 50s and you've been doing this for a long time. But it's just very like. Like, what are we accomplishing here? And like, the Fran Drescher paintings are funny, but also like a bit that like goes on for too long.
I guess I'm having another rude awakening. I'm all about dunking on millennials.
You
Give
are
me,
a millennial.
Country. I just want to guzzle it. So that's Wine Country. We're in the moment where like Netflix is going to have a movie every week and there's going to be a lot of famous people in it and people are going to get to make kind of crap and we sit through it for some reason.
Yeah.
Nothing profound.
I will go.
This is what we wanted. This is what we wanted years ago. Just like lots of whatever mid-budget movies.
Right. This is the mid-budget movie we all complain doesn't get made anymore and put in theaters. But I guess it saved us like $15 to go to the theater and see the movie. Somehow,
if I had gone to the theater to see Wine Country, like thinking about when I went to see Ocean's 8 last year and like went out in theaters and was like, yeah, it's fine. Like, I guess if I'd seen Wine Country in theaters, I would have been angry.
Enraged. Right. So Netflix is saving you. Netflix is keeping Amy Poehler's career intact because you did not pay to go.
Amy Poehler made Russian Doll for Netflix. Like, they're not doing her favors. She made a great show for them. Like, she, like, I guess, go back to the idea that she can do whatever she wants.
Fine. Wine Country 2. Because we can! Yes, we can! Okay, so this weekend, I got really, or no, it wasn't this week, it was this week. I got so lucky. Katie Rich came to town.
I did.
You were in New York
City.
It was
last week, but yeah.
Okay, whatever. You were
Time's
in
a flat
my
circle.
Orbit at some point. Yes, exactly. It really means nothing anymore. We saw a show together. We got to see Oklahoma back on Broadway. Now, if you recall, Katie, let me mansplain Oklahoma. You recently selected it for a quarter qualifier.
Yeah.
What was the quarter qual?
I will look that up while you do that, because it was something.
I think it was movies to show to kids.
Show to children?
No, because I picked the Music Man for that one. I feel
movies
like
that represent our homes?
No, because I'm not from Oklahoma. I'm going to look at it, but I picked it. I feel like not knowing that it was going to be making its way to Broadway. So the fact that, I was able to like have rewatched the movie really recently. Oh yeah. It's from the, lifelong evolving obsession quarter quell.
Oh yes.
So David picked Radiohead. I picked musicals. Dave picked Sherlock Holmes and Patches picked trivia.
Right. Now during that discussion, Dave, you watched Oklahoma for that.
Yeah, I watched Oklahoma for that quarter.
Do you recall anything about the movie? Because when we decided to go see Oklahoma, I had some fuzzy memories. I hadn't seen the movie in a long time when we rewatched it. So I had some choice memories, and some of the music was coming back to me. I listened to it all on Spotify to kind of get back in the Oklahoma vibe. It's a very old school Rodgers and Hammerstein musical classic. What do you have any memories of Oklahoma?
They kind of all blur together with like that era of musicals. I don't know. I see the problem is I watched a whole bunch of like Doris Day musical clips, and now they're all my musicals are blurring together.
That one scene from Calamity Jane does feel like it would be in Oklahoma.
True. Yeah. So I'm going to say, I don't specifically remember Oklahoma beyond.
What defines that type of musical for you in your mind when you think about how they structure it or how they stage things? I think Oklahoma is very representative to people for representing a certain type of musical theater or musical movie.
I see you're trying to lead me down the path of your further conversation, and
perhaps,
I appreciate the help. No, just take me there, Patches. Don't make me relive whether or not I could remember Oklahoma.
Okay, fine. Well, it's actually Oklahoma is pretty. Thinking about the movie again, it's pretty deranged. Like,
oh yeah,
there's some high stakes drama. It's a guy wants a girl and another guy wants a girl, and there's some serious violence in this show, and there's dream ballets, which is just far out. That all makes it into the movie version. And Katie, this version of Oklahoma somehow strips it down more and makes it more David Lynchian than I could have ever expected. This was the talk of the town. I got a bunch of Tony nominations, and I didn't know this was possible. Like, Oklahoma is a fun musical, you know. Oklahoma.
Oh yeah.
The people are clapping and stomping and rooting, tooting, good time.
And people do that in this production of Oklahoma. It should be said, like, it is very fun for a long time.
Okay, that's what I really want to get at, because I don't think it's fun. But it's provocative, and it's strange, and it's compelling, and it's absorbing, but it's not fun.
Huh.
And as we noted after watching it, they haven't changed anything. It's all the same music, and it's all
same dialogue,
same book,
yeah.
Same book. But like, what has been done to Oklahoma that's completely changed it, and why would you recommend someone go see this show? Like, I'm glad that you think it's fun. I think it's not a drag.
Like, you don't think that, like, I can't say no is fun? Like, when you're watching, like, the woman with, like, Ada Manning, like, kill it while performing in a wheelchair? Like, there's nothing, like, sinister about that scene.
All right. I'm the horse that's been led to your
Sorry,
thought process,
Dave.
Patches. And now, no. I just finally got it, and it clicked for me. I don't think that needs to be true of a revival. Like, you got to see Oklahoma on stage. I've never seen Oklahoma on stage. That's very rarely going to be an option for me.
Yeah.
Do I want revivals to necessarily have to have a point where they could like fuck it up, right?
Well, so like, no. I'm saying this is an achievement. I'm saying stripping it all away, this is what we should demand from remakes. This is what why Broadway can have a revival category at the Tonys, and we applaud every time someone relaunches a musical. this is not, and then in the movie world, we shame people for remaking properties or changing the core ideas of something. And yet Oklahoma, this version that's currently on Broadway, has completely been reinvented. I mean, yes, Katie, as Katie mentioned, there's some numbers that are still like showstoppers and the talent behind them. It's a hoot. But Katie, for the most part, that number is not representative of this version of Oklahoma, right? Like, what is this show doing?
So differently. I think that the show ends really differently. Like, the ending is really stark and provocative and makes you think about the way that stories can be resolved by violence and whether or not that is a valid way to watch your heroes resolve a story. But I think I disagree with you that most of the show isn't fun. Like, it's stripped down. It's really unusually presented. The house lights are on most of the time. The sets are really minimal. The music is really minimal. There's like seven musicians on. It's done in the round. So it's all very stripped down is the word for it. But I think the performances play really well. You've got Kansas City, this song sung by this kind of dim-witted character who's just trying to get the girl he loves, like, which is really fun. And he does a lot of dancing. And Aunt Eller is a character who has a lot of really funny lines. And she, you know, gets off all of her jokes. Like, the audience laughed a lot. They're clapping along with some of the songs. But then you get into the central love story where you've got this woman, Laurie, who's kind of torn between this very brutish and kind of scary man who she says scares her. And then the like very like sweet cowboy who just wants to take her to the box social. And a lot of the, you know, when I watched the original movie, I don't really understand why she's torn between them, because one guy is scary and mean and one guy loves her. And this movie does a lot to complicate that and then kind of gets to a violent resolution for that story. But I think it is a freshly presented version of the old Oklahoma for a long time until it really turns the whole thing on its head.
Well, we were talking about how, you know, again, none of the words have been changed, but suddenly you have different inflection, or this version of Oklahoma is about gender politics. Mm-hmm. It's about the tension of courtship and how these guys are both kind of scumbags as they pursue this woman they love. And then, like, the older woman, Aunt Eller is like urging her these to go, like, go off and be with these men. And it's just like this tension that how do you think that the show creates it? It's all through like little gestures and little moments. It's the reinvention here is not like rewriting the book. It's all performance. And I don't think we get a lot of that. We don't get to see that experiment in film and television very often, because things aren't being reimagined in that way. If there's a reimagining, it's like Tim Burton doing Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
Yeah.
Huge broad strokes, total visual reinterpretation. This is something like the Meisner technique, right? Like saying words slightly differently and they start having totally new meaning. That's what I got out of Oklahoma. Same thing. If you put the different emphasis on a different syllable, suddenly this woman is being attacked by a man who supposedly loves her.
Or this woman is, like, you know, kind of attracted to a man who's supposedly attacking her.
Right.
No, it's like what you see with Shakespeare a lot, where there's, like, a reinterpreted version of Romeo and Juliet where they're all, like, living in Venice Beach or something. And it's interesting to see it done with something that's much more modern. I like Oklahoma. Songs are good. Performances are great. Curly's real cute.
Well, we were talking, and this will be the way most people get to see this, unless you get them to New York in the near future to actually see Oklahoma. I'm sure there will be a cast album of this version of Oklahoma that goes on Spotify and other platforms eventually. I really want to hear from people if they listen to this and they get something out of it.
And you'll probably see it at the Tonys, too.
Oh, yeah, we'll get a taste of that. But you know what that's going to be? That's going to be what's her name singing her big song, because it's the most Tony.
Oh, the I Can't Say No.
Yeah, that's gonna be Addo Annie. But you know, these songs again are like really trippy and really pared down, and I wonder if it'll play in album four. So
yeah, I've been wondering that too.
Everyone listening here to tell us, since we got to experience it, but I think there'll be something, a whole different experience, audio only. So please tell us.
I refuse to listen to any cast recording until I see the physical production.
This is why Pasha still doesn't listen to Hamilton.
Hamil what?
as you guys might know, next week is the final episode of Game of Thrones. I don't know if you haven't spent any time online and maybe haven't gone out to shop for groceries or looked at any print media or listened to any radio, and you've only been listening to Fighting in the War Room, which has ignored it and then didn't have an episode last week, then maybe you are unaware that Game of Thrones' final episode is next Sunday. But as we wind down at a huge monoculture event. See, after seemingly just winding down Marvel Cinematic Universe, I was wondering how Game of Thrones coverage is looking for each of us going into this final thing. What are your Sundays like, Patches?
Well, I have to pull the curtain back for people here.
Not only as much as you're comfortable. I think it's going to be interesting because what I really want to see is that we're three people that like this show, like the majority of people watching it. But I think the way that we watch the show pulls us into different eddies of the discourse at different times, which I think makes the way that we watch the show actually on Sunday very different.
Well, that's what I want to establish right off the bat here, which is like, I want to talk about some of the things that have bubbled to the surface, especially after the last episode that have really have become divisive.
But I want to know how you watch the show first.
But what I want to say is that, Dave, you are really in deep. You talk about the show all the time. Do you watch episodes multiple times before you have your conversations, or do you usually watch it like once?
I watch it usually twice on Sunday, and then because my particular podcast involves the discourse and internet discussion and whatnot, I spend the rest of the time before recording brushing up on that. So reading everyone's posts and being in the Reddit thread and seeing what's being memed up, which has actually been very helpful this season because I've had a little bit of straight white male screenwriter blinders on, or straight brownish male, either way, just straight male screenwriters blinders on, where I have been surprised at some of the reactions to this year's plot developments, because I can see how their necessities of an abbreviated season, and the reality is they were five guys in a room a year and a half ago trying to put all the pieces together. And so they came up with this. And then, it's been interesting as the season's gone on and the inevitability of not being able to please everybody with the conclusion has also, I think, met a really hard-drawn line that the show is the show and the source material is the source material, which has been the part of the discourse that I've landed in.
We
spent so much time.
What is like the idea that the people who are upset about it are like upset about it on behalf of the books, or what does that mean?
The people who are upset about it now seem to think that the showrunners are bad writers, mm-hmm. and that they were given pieces that it because the last books aren't out yet. George R. R. Martin hasn't committed any of the missteps or mapped out his character is even beyond their midpoint, really, or their midpoint in what we would consider the television series. So it's been interesting to see. We all knew going into it that the showrunners knew what George R. R. Martin's ending would be. And so what I've seen the fandom of like really hardcore fans do is begin to cut ties with the show as just a TV show that is being executed like below its writing standards but at high technical standards. That's been the Venn diagram, is like we like how the show looks and we like the discourse of the show, but also we're starting to acknowledge maybe the books were always going to be better. Which I don't know how that's super surprising, but
yeah. And you haven't read the books, right?
I haven't, but then also in terms of the stuff that we're seeing now, I don't think we'll ever see like a vision from George R. R. Martin that's untainted by this reaction. So I don't think we'll ever know if this. I made a comparison and then forgot to look up the name of the anime. But there's an anime that my friend Julian watches that it was adapted from a manga, and they did so many episodes of the anime, they caught up to the manga, and then the manga publishing took a break, so the anime just decided what the story was going to be, and then when the manga came back and finished its story, the anime just went back and picked up from where it left off, so it has, like, two branching timelines. But that's essentially how I think Game of Thrones is going to operate as a master story, because already the fandom's upset, but not upset in a way that it's going to, I think, like, poison the perception of the show necessarily.
I mean, I think it's less about, like, what the fandom, like, because me, as someone who hasn't read the books and, like, doesn't really intend to, like, I'm annoyed with the show for plenty of reasons. And I think, like, what they've done is important and is upsetting people and, like, maybe shouldn't be upsetting people for reasons that have nothing to do with how it's diverging from the books. It's just about, like, what they're presenting on television in this year of 2019.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say anything critical about the show without getting into this didn't feel right, or what if this had happened? Like, I found, like, I outwrote the show as, like, a fan of the show. So it is, in that sense, like, it's a great television show. And I try to, you know, tweet that every once in a while just to remind people that's, like, the base of all my thoughts. It's like there's this huge television show that's being operated in a way that we've never seen television operate before, and it might be the last show that's capable of operating this way. So it's like, this is it. This is a, I don't know, a solar eclipse or a lunar eclipse or whichever one is the most rare. Maybe comes once along, you know, solar eclipse. And we get to watch it. It's not that it's beyond judgment. I just think it's beyond, like you were saying, it's an important show, and that it's always going to have that. The same way that it took, like, a couple of years after the Lost finale or the Battlestar Galactica finale for people to come back and reckon with it. I think that'll still happen with Game of Thrones, but even more so because the source material is a never-ending mystery box, at least as far as we know now.
Mm-hmm.
Has been
so
for years.
Not, I mean, the source material is not a factor. Like, people, not many people have read the books in the grand of things, based on how many people watch this show on a weekly basis. The percentage is low.
Sure, but I think it's like, it's a pocket, it's a trapdoor for your feelings, because
it's a Hodor.
Knowing that there are unfinished books out there means that there is another way out.
There is a perfect theoretical version of Game of Thrones out there somewhere.
But that's when,
exactly.
You're like, that's when your people are so close to the characters. To go back to your very first question, I'm very removed from Game of Thrones in terms of, like, my emotional connection to watching it. And part of that is my job, where I'm, like, going into critical mode and thinking about the show immediately after, which can be unfortunate sometimes when you're trying to process something for everyone and really ding deep immediately. You become removed from the action, and I don't get to luxuriate in the choices and meditate on if they were right or wrong. I feel like that's the wrong critical thinking anyway, but to feel those characters' decisions, to feel the weight of every episode, I think in the years since I've been watching it and covering it more, I've lost a little bit of that, so has the show. I mean, the show is not, I often tell people that there's before the Red Wedding and after the Red Wedding in terms of both, like, how the show's dynamics work and also my memory of the show. That, like, I cannot even fathom watching those first few seasons. Like, it's so distant. It feels like history now, which is good because that's part of what the show is really all about. But I would imagine, and I think people will have a totally different reaction to what's going on in this season when people watch it from beginning to end. And it feels like one continued narrative where the Stark family feels close and the memories of those who fell at the Red Wedding linger more. I mean, between 7 and 8, there's more than a year between these seasons. Like, even 7 and 8 should be probably viewed all together in one swoop. I've always been really repellent towards the, like, oh, geography doesn't matter anymore. They can just jump everywhere. I made somebody at Polygon write about an idea that I had because I can't actually commit to writing this because I don't have the cred, but Game of Thrones is really working on video game logic now, where there's fast travel and we have all the weapons and we're leading to the final bosses and everything's blowing up in our faces. I like that it has exponentially grown, and the rules, the dramatic rules of, like, we have to travel far distances, or it could take a character so long to get from point A to point B, the reality of the world, that has been shifted out of play in favor of just, like, moving the needle, not the sword, the metaphorical needle. Is that right? Is that a reference?
Yes, needle's the name of the sword.
Applause for me. Hold for applause. My point is, even though that I'm going in more removed from the action of Game of Thrones, I've never been someone who can connect so deeply with a fictional character that I would feel offended by the choice. The way that I grapple with narrative and my love for this stuff comes from those choices. I'm interested in seeing a creator either impress people or falter or make a choice that seems out of line. And I look forward to seeing the show in the macro. And, you know, the thing that we're all kind of revolving around right now is this conversation about Daenerys, I think, and her arc and what that means for the show. And has it always been there, this turn that we saw, this viciousness that was present when she scorched King's Landing into the next dimension? I mean, it was just shocking. This episode was really beautiful and horrifying, brutal. I mean, there's nothing like what we saw in this, in The Bells, this past episode. But I will want to rewatch it when the dust settles. I think the discourse is too much. This, I really do feel like we're watching a book play out, a really long movie, to use a abused trope in TV, the golden age of television. But it's true. Like, I feel like the drip, drip, drip is bad for Game of Thrones.
I feel like,
and I look forward to getting away from it.
I'm going to miss this period of watching a story and being able to talk about it midway through, yeah, with people. Of true, like true. Sitting there and saying to ourselves, are they going to end it with Daenerys being destroyed by her own ambition? Like, at this point, I think it's kind of obvious that that will happen, so it might not be as much of a question. But we don't know what's going to happen to her. We don't know if she's going to get executed, if she's somehow, like, if Jon Snow's going to take the throne. And that idea of not consuming a story all at once, or not being expected to have consumed a story all at once, I don't know how much longer it's going to exist. Like, serialized television that's stripped out like this doesn't happen much more. But I feel nostalgic for wondering what was going to happen to Walter White at the end of Breaking Bad, or like wondering if Don Draper was ever going to like come clean about being Dick Whitman. Like, there's this collective experience of a story that, you're right, we don't have all the pieces, we don't know, and it's in people jumping to conclusions and saying like Game of Thrones is bad for women, you know, we don't know yet. But that collective storytelling I still really value.
But I think the audience needs to trust it more, because it's so rare. I think that because all eyeballs are on Game of Thrones, we don't know how to have these weekly conversations anymore. We've kind of like lost our tact when it comes to letting the showrunners get us to the end and then pulling back. Like, I want to have that weekly conversation, but I don't want, I mean, and this is the coverage too, like our side of things, everybody is reading these stories. Full transparency. It's unfathomable that everyone can be writing about Game of Thrones, and everybody sees the benefit of that, so they produce more conversation about Game of Thrones. And the amount of discussion is hard to bear, because it's the only show, as you said, that's coming out week to week. Every moment is going to be scrutinized. That means every moment is going to be questioned. And to go back to Dave's point, every moment is going to be pinned to the creators somehow. Like, we spend so much time living in the world of Westeros and Game of Thrones and seeing it and just considering the plot and considering these deep characters we've lived with for 8 seasons. And yet little things, I mean, they don't feel little to people. They're major turns of the story, but like, how do people get snapped out of the world, out of the fiction of it, so quickly, and pin things to the creators? I can't help but think of The Last Jedi and the discourse around that movie, that, like, you're messing with the thing that I know, instead of, like, considering it in the grand scheme of things, or the world of the plot, or the world of Star Wars. Why are we not having more conversations that feel in world about the show? This season seems more removed.
I think you're,
because it's the payoff season.
I think that you get a straw man argument there. I think there's been plenty of arguments about in-world drama. Dave, you've been paying attention to it more than I have.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think there is a lot of arguments about in-world drama, but mostly, like, I think the whole wait and see if it's done thing, it kind of lets them off the hook for it being, like, a television show. Like, the reality is they could have done as many episodes as they wanted, and HBO would have paid for it, because that's the way it is.
I mean...
No, there are other factors, absolutely. Or they could have done, you know, just two more episodes or something. The thing is, I think it was D.B. Weiss, one of the showrunners, one time said that, like, themes, in response to people asking why their episodes didn't have, like, more coherent themes, he said themes were something for, like, an eighth grade literature essay.
No, that was David Benioff talking to Andy Greenwald at Grantland.
Okay, thank you very much.
Look at me make references.
Oh, good. I'm glad you corrected. I would hate to slander the wrong showrunner. but that sort of thinking is enabled by wait till we're done and we're not responsible anymore. Whereas week-to-week television is partially based on having a conversation. Week-to-week season-to-season television is based on having a conversation with your audience, usually.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point, I think you could... I understand where you're coming from, Patches, that you have a whole bunch of people who are fans of things and passionate about things being like, this must be bad writing because I don't like it. Except I do think in this case, like, there wasn't a ton of track laid for some of the decisions simply because they didn't have time, simply because they chose not to have time. We got to see Jaime Lannister say goodbye to Tyrion Lannister 3 times, but we didn't get a ton of other scenes that could have just been two-handers filling in some gaps we have to assume.
It just seems so presumptuous. It seems like, how can any of us tell them how to make the show? What would have been better?
No, because ultimately they're not listening, but this is what a critical conversation is.
Yeah, but like, what is being a fan of something if not looking at it and thinking, like, you know, here's what I would have done instead. Like, no one has to listen to you doing your whining, and the showrunners certainly aren't listening to you. But I feel like you're equating, like, the, you know, the bad faith Star Wars fans who don't like Rey because she's a girl with people who just have ideas about how they want their shows to play out. What are you mad about? Yeah, like,
why is that so different?
Because the act of enjoying something, and, you know, especially serialized storytelling, is thinking to yourself, I do like this thing and I don't like this thing. Like, it's as old as fan fiction, and it goes back before that.
Also, I should note that I'm not talking about people who think Rey is bad because they hate women or something. That's not everybody who doesn't like
it. Sure, but Jedi. What is the thing about, what is also the reaction to Game of Thrones that you are mad about? Is it the idea that, like, they should have done X scene with Daenerys that would have, like, what is it that you feel like is in bad faith?
Yeah, I mean, I've seen a lot of conversations about, like, if you had moved this part to, if you had done this scene or added this thing, if I would have been writing the show, then it would have all worked out. And I think that what's more interesting is going to be, especially after we see the final episode, how that plays in relation to what we just saw in this episode. It feels like a two-parter where we only get to see the first half. But also, you know, to consider Daenerys over 8 seasons and consider all these actions, I'm more interested in the timeline and people talking about this character's life and everything and the emotional trauma that she's been through and what could possibly have been going through her head to allow this to happen. This is what happened. I mean, that's what the show, this is the text that we are dealing with. I'm not going to say here's what should have happened or here's what could have happened if I had written it. Like, this is the text. So let's deal with the text and try and make sense of it all. I think that in this modern time that we're in, we want to knock a show for not following the rules of social conversation or not considering every person who could possibly be watching it. There's no way to do this. This is also just the syndrome of, like, wrapping up the television show. We go through this with the final season of every show, it feels like. And Game of Thrones, as we're learning, is not, you know, will not dodge final season syndrome, which is like, this is how it was all supposed to wrap up with me. And especially a show with so many theories and so much fan fiction that just naturally blossoms out of conversation. I mean, shipping in the big, you know, when we got Jaime and Brienne, this moment that shippers have been waiting for so long, And then to see it kind of play out the way that it did, it broke hearts, really was legitimately devastating for many people. And I am so empathetic to that experience because I know how deep these emotions run for people. But like at the end of the day, this is what happened. Why did it happen? I don't see a lot of people considering Jaime and Cersei in these moments. I see them angry about Jamie and Brienne because they assume that Jamie must think one way, or, you know, it's,
I feel like you're just following the wrong people on Twitter. Like, I feel like you're talking about how these people are consuming the show in a way that you don't like, but that's,
where am I, like, am I saying that I don't like it? I'm just saying that this is what I see.
Yeah, but you're talking about how, like, people need to embrace the show as it is and accept it. And I think plenty of people are doing it that while also having valid complaints. I think if you're sitting there and saying, I don't know what was going on in this character's head when this major thing happened, maybe that's a fault of the show. And you know, you can think that that is a critique without having some idealized version of what's going to be happening there. But it does sound like you're not used to this process of watching something play out serially and talk about it bit by bit, and that you're annoyed by it.
How am I? You're putting so many words in my mouth. Sure, here.
Like, what is, in terms of all this Game of Thrones discourse, what do you wish was different?
I mean, I'm not saying that anything should be different. I'm just saying the things about the show that excite me are the choices that I don't see coming, or the, you know, when Brienne breaks down in tears because Jaime's leaving her. My initial reaction isn't like, this is a violation. I would never say something that is a violation of a show. I would say, why did this happen? Or like, why, you know, it's interesting that she's breaking down in tears. She's a powerful person, and me, and it's not.
Okay. Another question to try to probe deeper into this. You watch Breaking Bad, right?
Yeah.
So now that Breaking
Bad's
over.
Also didn't like the end of that show, by the way.
Sure. Now that Breaking Bad's over. In terms of how Skyler was treated,
yes,
as a character and by the fandom,
yes,
are the writers or is the fandom at fault for that?
The fandom is at fault for that, in my opinion. Because I think Skyler is an amazing character who was written in a compelling way, where she made some bad choices along the way, was seen as a nag by certain types of fans, but like is trying to get through the most difficult situation in her life, trying to grapple with a villain, a true villain in the end, and again suffering great trauma and trying to be strong but not always being strong, and then going along with it for a little while and then realizing this is a horrible decision. She's such a complicated, wonderful, dimensional character, and I, you know, people who hate Skyler, that really makes me raise my eyebrow, because I don't see,
raise your
really
eyebrow, oh god.
I'm raising my eyebrow. Ow, it hurts. Because I don't see people really dealing with the nuance and the intricacies of the actual text. And there's probably a flip side to this where the feelings are more positive about characters. And maybe that's my thing with Game of Thrones, that like, let's just go through the whole show. Let's talk about the whole character arc. Let's see this person as a real person and not,
but I think you can also.
I'm very defensive of Skyler. I guess.
That's I mean, no. But my counter argument to that would be, if the fandom didn't come up and bring it to the attention of the showrunners, this nag angle, the showrunners could have accidentally continued leaning into it, because that was just a blind spot.
But how? What do you mean it was a blind spot? What are you talking about?
The,
like, why
you wrote her as the practical character who we're supposed to be seeing as relatable, but because of they had created this antihero at the center of the show, she was the person standing between Walter White and what he wanted, and it made people turn against her. But they didn't.
Right,
think that
but
that
that's
was
not. The, but how is that the fault of the script? How is that the fault of the writers?
But they should know that to like make things more complex. If this wasn't the final season of Game of Thrones, don't we want the showrunners to be listening to us, telling us they're doing it wrong?
Do I want the showrunners of Game of Thrones to be listening to us?
Like the Game of Thrones, so like responded to people who were upset about how much random female nudity there was on the show, and they've cut back on it because it was sexist.
Or then, like, but like the difference between the type of media that is consumed the way you're arguing it is, which is like get to the end, which is something like, you know, a novel or a movie or something, that's
or a Netflix series,
a complete work, or a Netflix series, and week-to-week television that's going to be aired week-to-week and, you know, could send out screeners but doesn't, could control the conversation around itself, but decides this is the scrum that it wants to have. I think that is the kind of conversation that you need to have with that type of show. And if the show's not listening to its audience, even at the end, that's, I think, something that's wrong with the medium isn't meeting the message.
But what do you think that Game of Thrones is not hearing then? In that, using your example, how are they not responding to the audience? And should people who make art be like taking notes and incorporating that? That's an interesting take.
So after
but
like
what is Game of Thrones
in between like
under?
Season 4 and season 5, which is when they go off book material and into show material, they also lose their only female director after losing their only female writer after season 2, and they just buckle down and they're like, we're the guys who are going to finish this story.
Mm-hmm.
And at any point after, especially after Unbound Bent Unbroken, which was written by Brian Cogman, who turned in a beautifully written episode this season, it sounds like if you do yell at them, they do hear you and they do try to be better. Some of them did. So why not just hire a woman? That seemed like a good place. Hire a person of color the last two seasons have been like winnowing down the women and the people of color to, yes, very important characters, so I get it, but also characters that are going to have to die or do very specific things. And I don't think they were aware of that around it. And it's not like we haven't been trying to tell them since Misa or Unbound, Unbrent, Unbroken. For years, the fandom's been trying to say, like, hey, this made us uncomfortable.
What?
And they...
What feels to me like a blind spot is I think the message of Game of Thrones is that anyone, and Joanna and I talked about this on the Still Watching podcast, which is out now. You can listen to it. Dave edited it. That anyone who pursues the throne is doomed. Like, if you want to be on the Iron Throne, you are therefore not the person who should be in charge, which, right, I think is a really valid message for the show to land on. Like, we've watched plenty of men.
It's a true political message.
Yeah, it's watching plenty of men be undone by it. And now Daenerys is the person who's being undone by it. And I think that they thought of it and saying, okay, she's the latest leader we're going to see destroyed by her pursuit of the throne. But what I imagine is a blind spot for this all-male writer's room is recognizing what it would be like to see this female figure who so many people have put so much into then turn into the sociopathic monster. And I think that there is a larger context for that that they, in the interest of telling their story, which I think is their prerogative, didn't see. And definitely could have tuned into better either by listening to the way that people were responding to the show or maybe having women writing.
Yeah, no, well, to make a few points here. One, yeah, why doesn't this room have a female writer on it? It doesn't actually make any sense. If they were wise, they would do that. I understand wanting to control this. This is their pet project. They've been working on this for like 10 years. And in the last stretch of seasons, they wanted to write most of the scripts. Makes perfect sense, actually. If you're an artist and you're really in deep and you don't listen to fandom because you know that it doesn't take a mass population to make great art. It does make sense to control it that way. But I gotta be honest.
It makes a novelist and a filmmaker sense, which is what the dudes are. So I understand that.
Well,
I don't
we could also,
that point.
Well, we could also talk about what's the great, I mean, this is a can of worms to talk about later, but what's been the greatest piece of art that's been made by the giant community of the internet? That's discussing later. The Veronica Mars movie. Okay, that's a great example. That's a whole can of worms. We should definitely talk about that though, because I'm interested in pursuing that. The art made by the mass internet. I have a much bigger problem, looking back at least in the last few weeks, with Sansa's admission of like growing as a character because of her rape. And because of her trauma, that felt like the biggest misstep in the last few years of this show. As someone, I love Sansa. If my Skylar rant here was not clear, I obviously would love Sansa because I feel like she falls into a similar bucket and people get annoyed with her in a similar way to Skylar. When the writing does seem true most of the time and people misinterpret, or at least people hear women speak in a certain way and get offended. And I think Sansa's fallen into that trap. And then they do have a misstep in this season. I do think conversation with, was it the Hound? Who was she talking to? Okay. Yeah,
it was with the Hound.
Oof, that did not sit well with me. I was really offended by that.
See, that was one of the things that passed me by until somebody dragged me by the nose back to it and explained to me why it was wrong, which I think was why the discourse is good.
I mean, I guess, but you're not, yeah, no.
I was like, oh, isn't it great that these characters got a chance to see each other? Sure. This was a meeting I wasn't
expecting. I hope that as an editor, I can help find good writers to contribute to the discourse. I don't think the discourse is bad. I don't think the discourse is bad. I think types of discourse are bad. I think types of telling people what to do is bad. I think critical writing about the show is good. And I think investigating the show is good. I don't think I'm being nuanced here when I have this conversation with you all about like what the discourse is all about. The discourse is a very broad spectrum, and I think slivers of it.
Well, and you ask like, what is the best use of art made by the whole of the internet? And like, I think that's another straw man. Like, obviously there's not an answer for that. But I think if you are making a piece of art and you have a handful of very smart people saying, hey, maybe you should have thought about this scene, how it played. And then a whole lot of people being like, wow, that really didn't work for me. Like, that's a very specific note getting that is worth incorporating into what you're going to do next.
Yeah, but I mean, the problem is whose notes are the priorities? I mean, whose notes?
Well, that's up to you. Like, you as the showrunner get to decide what feedback you want to
take. But isn't that what they're doing and it blows up in their face? Like, what do you mean? Like, who gets to decide whose notes are the most important? Which people should be represented? Who gets to be at the table? Like, who?
The showrunners, they get to decide. And if they make a bad choice and like make a show that isn't working for people, they'll continue hearing it. Like, it's exactly. Their show in the end, but there are all these pitfalls they keep falling into that they could have avoided. I think that is the thing that frustrates me.
That's the only
people.
Type of comparison I'm making to The Last Jedi stuff. I'm talking about people who are like telling Rian Johnson what he's done to Star Wars by making a choice and going in this direction. Luckily, we think that's really positive. We like The Last Jedi. But for some people who are loud and angry, they have an emotional reaction and are telling someone, a creator, that they did it wrong. Whereas there's a lot of legitimate people who like don't like The Last Jedi because, and they've written long critical essays about this. Whatever the narrative didn't work. I'm saying there's a reverse of that that sounds more positive because it's actually like socially conscious and something that we all also believe in, even if I think it's like a strange misstep to start targeting the creators of a show versus reckoning with it in the context of the show. I can't wait to watch The Bells like 800 more times to see all the acting that is going on. The Emilia Clarke like sitting on a dragon looking at the Red Keep. I mean, I want to watch that clip so many more times just to like watch the gears turn. And I want to also think about it in the large grand context. I mean, obviously I haven't watched all 100 episodes of Game of Thrones and leading up to this episode back to back to back to back to back to really like feel the momentum. And of course, as you said, like we're experiencing week to week, which is important. That's part of how people are expected to watch the show and talk about it. But I think for this season, my grand point here after this whole conversation is like, I'm kind of missing the momentum of Game of Thrones. I'm missing the magnitude that I want to be feeling as we go into the, and as characters make huge life-changing decisions.
Why do you feel like you're not feeling that magnitude?
I don't know. I think maybe the year off, like, took some wind out of the sails.
Don't blame the discourse for that, though.
Isn't just the end?
I'm not. What just the why end do you think I'm blaming you? The discourse? I'm not
Dave,
blaming all
the discourse.
Yeah, Patches always blames the discourse.
Well, if I do it consistently and I'm always blaming the discourse, then I'm
on brand.
Well, like, I'll blame Patchett, would you say Game of Thrones is for the critics or the fans, Patchett?
I would say it's for neither, unfortunately, for D.B. Weiss and David Benioff. They're doing it for themselves.
I mean, that sounds like a shitty way to make a TV show, but that was the point of this entire segment on Game of Thrones.
Well, that does it for this week's Fighting in the War Room. We'll be back next week, but Dave won't be on, so we may or may not talk about Game of Thrones ever again. Can that be? We'll probably talk about it.
Why is Dave not going to be on?
Oh, I have to do a live show for a Storm of Spoilers Game of Thrones finale in San Francisco, and so I will be doing another podcast at the time you guys do this.
Traitor.
Can we just like take clips of that and incorporate that into our show
it's going to be our live show on our podcast feed, Patches. But you know, maybe I'll try to get the guys to send you something. So it sounds like next week You gotta have a lot of some call-in clips with Patches and Katie's call-in hour, because Dave is gonna be sending something. Maybe I could send something. You guys just have to get together for like 20 minutes and talk about whatever's on Netflix.
Is that what you think we do?
We will have our discourse. We will have our
The next episode's going to be about monetizing your children, and it's going to be 60 minutes.
Oh, that's true. We'll soft launch our parenting podcast. We'll be back next week. Tell people who you are.
I am Matt Patches. I am a senior editor at Polygon.com, and we're forging Game of Thrones discourse in a positive way. I'm really happy with it. I got to say, I'm really happy with Polygon's coverage of Game of Thrones. I think it's insightful. I think it's trying to push the conversation forward. And I think it's level-headed. I like it. There's a lot of chatter about Game of Thrones, but like, let's take some deep breaths and talk about this grand show. It's never been done before. It's crazy. Some of it's good. Some of it's bad. It's my long way of saying we have a website, fightinginthewarroom.com, where you can go listen to episodes, you can share them with your friends, or you can jump in the comments and talk about Game of Thrones, because it's an up-and-down process. Game of Thrones. Is it good? Is it bad? I don't know. But Fighting the Worm's good.
So good, you should leave us a review on iTunes. I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can follow me on Twitter at DA7E. If you, for some reason, don't like Game of Thrones and are still listening to this podcast, my podcast, Storm of Spoilers, is going to become a Lost rewatch podcast. We're going to go episode by episode, week by week, through season one, through, I think, September that takes us. We start next week.
There's a show that just listened to all the fans and totally curbed all the writing. They just heard the discourse and they're like, you know,
Patches, you're gonna really like this Lost rewatch podcast, because for a whole section of our podcast I'm going to take the stance that you want to take, which is that this all makes sense. Let me show you how I can shove this square peg in this
bring room. Me on the show and I will tell you.
I've writing down what shots, you know, occur after lock and whether or not they involve smoke monster sounds. So we're already on the way for the pilot.
This is how TV.
That's a Star Wars spoiler.
Meant to be watched.
Go ahead and subscribe if that sounds interesting.
I'm Katie Rich. I'm at VanityFair.com, where Joanna Robinson is doing her final weeks of heroic Game of Thrones work, and I am working with her on that. So I will not take any credit for her work. But if you wonder what I'm up to and why I suddenly know things about Game of Thrones, like that little finger died, it's because I'm working with Joanna. And I'm, as I mentioned, I'm on this week's So Watching podcast, which we're talking about Game of Thrones and why Euron Greyjoy is the worst, but went out in proper fashion. I'm on Twitter at Katie Rich, KateyRich, and we're all on Twitter at FITWR, where Patches would love to hear your theories on how this past week at Game of Thrones could have been better.
Those are not the Game of Thrones theories that I don't think. I like Game of Thrones.
I just like
theories.
To read your spec script for last week's episode of what you think should have happened.
I don't know any of your script notes for the executive.
You can also answer this week's lightning round question, which was:
in honor of John Wick Chapter 3, what's your favorite horse-based action sequence? Get those gifts
Thanks
out.
Thanks for listening, and we'll be back talking to you next week.
It must be nice, it must be nice to have the Washingtons on your side. It must be nice, it must be nice to have everybody on your side. It must be nice, it must be nice to have the Washingtons by your side. It must be nice, it must be nice to have everybody by your side.